This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The politics of Greece, the NFL, and standardized testing. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Adrienne Hill in for Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you with us here this Monday, December 29th. There's a lot of news out of Greece today. A ferry disaster in which at least 10 people have died. And a political upheaval. The parliament in Athens has failed to choose a new president. That's triggered a general election next month. And it's an election that could be won by a radical anti-austerity, anti-bailout party called Syriza. From London, Stephen Beard reports the election has implications for the entire European economy.
Investors voted with their feet today. The prospect of Syriza forming the next Greek government sparked a stampede. The main share index in Athens fell at one point by more than 10%. But Syriza's chief economic advisor, Yanis Milios, dismissed this as overreaction.
When our program becomes clear, when people see that Syriza is going to stabilize society and through that to stabilize the economy, we will have a very good result.
But the party advocates radical measures like rolling back some of the public spending cuts imposed in return for two hefty bailouts and writing off some of the billions of euros Greece has borrowed. That, says Konstantin Mikalos of the Athens Chamber of Commerce, has raised fears that Greece might be forced out of the eurozone, causing yet further problems for the Greek economy.
Flight of capital, freezing of investments, and creating problems for our external trade. It's moments of agony that we're going through at the moment.
The trouble is, says fund manager Colin McLean, if Greeks do elect Syriza, it could have repercussions well beyond their own borders, bolstering Germany's opposition to monetary easing across the stagnant eurozone.
Germany is not sure about putting more bailouts or printing money, so it might expose those divisions.
After a quiet 2014, the eurozone looks set once again to become a major focus of international investor unease in 2015. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
One of the day's biggest news stories is sadly a familiar one. AirAsia Flight 8501 went missing during a flight to Singapore. Many of the questions we have today are the same questions we've asked before. What happened and where and how? But a less familiar element has been the quick response by the company and its CEO. Marketplace's Dan Weissman takes a look at the airline.
This story has been an introduction for U.S. audiences to an iconic Asian CEO and the innovative company he created. In 2001, Tony Fernandez took over AirAsia and its enormous debts for 29 cents. He had a new idea, a budget airline for Asia. It's like Spirit Airlines in the U.S., super low fares, zero frills, but without the customer vitriol, AirAsia gets great ratings for customer satisfaction. Vinay Bascara is a senior business analyst with Airways News. He says the difference is the customer that AirAsia serves.
They're really grabbing passengers who have never flown before. And, you know, they're very transparent about their business model and they're very clear about, you know, you're going to have to pay extra if you want extra.
For these customers, flying itself is a huge upgrade. The airline's motto, now everyone can fly. By 2013, AirAsia was a network of regional airlines, and Fernandez was starring on an Asian version of The Apprentice. Richard Turin is a senior contributing editor for Travel Weekly.
And all these young business people were dying to work with him because of the mystique and also because of what he actually had accomplished.
Fernandez has branched out in other ways. He has a majority stake in an English Premier League football team, that's soccer to you and me, and a chain of budget hotels that Turin says also fill a new niche.
Yes, you can go to a resort, but no, it doesn't have to be stuffy. And no, you don't have to pay $70 for for breakfast.
As the weekend's tragedy unfolded, Fernandez sent out multiple emotional tweets, calling the event his worst nightmare. I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
The Dow today surrendered its winning streak. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Before the year ends, we're checking in with some of our Marketplace beat reporters and what they're watching for next year. Today, we're chatting about education, where one of the biggest stories of 2014 was standardized testing, or more specifically, the backlash against standardized testing. Marketplace's Amy Scott joins us now from our education desk at WYPR in Baltimore. Hi, Amy.
Hey, Adrian.
So a whole lot of folks protested this year about test after test after test for kids in classrooms. What are you expecting next year in 2015?
Probably more of the same. This spring, we'll be seeing the first big round of testing tied to the new Common Core standards, which more than 40 states have adopted. And opposition to the standards themselves, of course, has been growing, but the tests are also expected to be harder. And in states like New York, where students have already taken them, scores have plummeted. Much of the testing will also be computerized rather than pencil and paper, so there's some resistance there. And so you have a lot of stressed out kids and parents who are really worried about how their kids are going to do on these tests and how their scores will be used.
How did we get to the point where kids are spending so many days testing?
Well, the big push really dates back to No Child Left Behind, you know, the federal education law that George W. Bush signed 13 years ago. And it required states to test kids from grades 3 through 8 every year and then once in high school. And it held schools accountable for making progress on those tests. But many schools also have additional state and district tests, which is how you get to schools that have, you know, 60 to 80 days devoted to testing.
What's the problem? What do people who say we're testing kids too much say?
Well, teachers say it's disruptive to the school day and that spending a lot of time preparing for tests is not the same thing as learning. I spoke with Linda Hansen, who's a reading specialist in Arlington, Massachusetts, and also the president of the teachers union there. She says teachers agree that some standardized testing is appropriate, you know, to keep track of how kids are doing and how schools are doing.
But this overemphasis on accountability, first and foremost, feels like it's really taking the focus and attention away from where it should be, which should be on helping teachers become better at what they do so students can learn more.
And, you know, even U.S. Education Secretary Arne Duncan said in an op-ed earlier this year that testing issues are, quote, sucking the oxygen out of the room in a lot of schools. So this backlash has really reached all the way to the top.
So are we going to see fewer tests in 2015, do you think?
Well, in the past few years, several states and school boards have moved to reduce the number of tests that students take. And the Council of Chief State School Officers, which represents, you know, the heads of education in states, is leading sort of an audit of the amount of testing and the quality around the country. Meanwhile, No Child Left Behind is long overdue for a rewrite. And if that finally happens with this next Congress, it is likely to take on this issue of testing.
Marketplace's Amy Scott, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Eastern Congo has been a conflict zone for decades. By some estimates, 6 million people have died as rival militias have battled for control of the land since the 1990s. Some parts of the region are now finally in a cautious period of peace and reconstruction. But turning the Democratic Republic of Congo around will be a long process. One of its many challenges is the assimilation of tens of thousands of child soldiers who fought in the 2 decades of war there. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore visited the eastern Congolese town of Bukavu to see how life has changed for some of those former child soldiers.
On the side of this busy road here in Bukavu, young men in their early 20s are zapping a broken motorcycle taxi with a welder. Putting things back together seems an apt profession for people whose lives came to pieces as children.
I was out in the countryside taking care of some cattle, and they took me. That's how it started.
That's Daniel Baguma, and they were the Mai Mai, one of dozens of armed groups fighting in Congo in the early 2000s. The country's infrastructure and government had collapsed after Rwanda's genocide spilled into the Congo. Thousands of children were swept into the fighting as sources of labor or as fighters. Baguma was just 12 when they took him.
I started carrying luggage for them. All of a sudden, you don't have a home anymore. You just go, you're just walking through whatever town you find yourself in. You're just dispersed.
Baguma remembers those days as he sits down to dinner with friends, many of them former child soldiers like himself. It's a bit like a reunion for Peter Pan's Lost Boys.
I was smoking a lot of weed and taking drugs. These were the Mai Mai drugs. You inject them and people can't shoot you. I regret it. It messed with my mind.
Pascal Birashirwa was even younger than Baguma when he was taken, just age 10.
Sometimes they would give me food, sometimes not. Sometimes the commanders would eat and leave me to guard the camp. I couldn't leave, though. It was all I knew.
None of these young men liked talking about what they did or saw done.
I never killed people, only enemies. And whatever happened out there stays out there.
When their groups demobilized in 2010, the boys found their way back to town. Everyone thought they had died.
They were so happy to see me.
But 7 years on the run had a price.
My family was disappointed. They say I could have gone to school, but I just came back smoking weed and cigarettes.
When we compare our lives with the life of someone who stayed in town, stayed in school, did the usual route, they have successful lives. We're still just figuring ours out.
While many Congolese sympathize with former child soldiers, they often suspect them as well. It can make finding work difficult.
I spent a year basically doing nothing.
Learning some basic literacy and some kind of skill or vocation has been critical to reintegrating young people whose childhoods were stolen by armed groups. But sometimes they've needed to learn things that were much more basic.
You're allowed to make eye contact with people. It's okay to disagree with people when you're having a conversation. You are valuable as a person, and you have the right to determine your own future.
Jocelyn Kelly is director of the Harvard Humanitarian Initiative.
I mean, these are the skills that are so incredibly human and basic, but often, especially young girls who are in armed groups, had no idea that this was something that was available to them.
HHI helped do a study of what worked and what didn't when integrating former child soldiers. A lot of groups have tried a lot of different things.
Cash payouts, a kit that has basic household goods. It can involve trying to engage people in a small income-generating activities.
Fly-by-night operations that gave young people a goat and a pat on the back and then left after 3 months did not work. And former child soldiers whose psychological needs weren't met suffered. Some ended up institutionalized.
I mean, it's kind of the foundation of everything that you're then expected to do. So if you don't have that just basic capacity to engage with people, to overcome anxiety or symptoms of PTSD, you're not going to be able to be engaged with the job in any way, shape, or form.
Both Pascal Birashirwa and Daniel Baguma were lucky enough to find a place at Laissez Afrique Vivre, a school for former child soldiers. They learned welding. For Baguma, who now has his own children, his new career seems to be working out.
Business is good. I know a lot of people who respect my work. I have work. I make my money. I feed my children.
Pascal Birashirwa is having a little more trouble.
I could have gone to school, had a life. Welding is giving me money day to day, but I can't plan anything bigger than that.
At the welding shop, former child soldiers are smoothing off some scarred metal on a door they repaired. They're trying to smooth away their own scars, too. In Bukavu, Eastern Congo, I'm Sabri Benachour for Marketplace.
Coming up, Colorado rolls up its first year of legal marijuana.
We have over 250 shops in the Denver area, which is more than we have Starbucks.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average traded down less than a tenth of 1% to end at 18,038. The Nasdaq traded flat to slightly lower at 4,806, while the S&P 500 ticked up 1 point, about a tenth of a percent, to finish at 2090. Oil prices took another dive today. A barrel of Brent crude fell more than a dollar to $57.88. The news moved ConocoPhillips stock up a third of 1%. Chevron stock rose less than a tenth of a percent, while Exxon Mobil dropped a tenth of a percent. Computer hardware companies lost some ground today. Microsoft shares dropped 2.8%. IBM slipped 1%, and Intel fell 0.9%. Stocks in Athens closed down nearly 4%. Here in the U.S., bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.2%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. As you know, Marketplace has been on the air for 25 years. I've said it before, I'll say it again, that could not have happened without support from listeners like you. In honor of the milestone, we set a goal of reaching at least 2,500 donations by December 31st, and we are so close. Please help us meet our goal so that we can continue to provide relevant and compelling coverage for many years to come. And your tax-deductible gift in any amount counts twice, thanks to a dollar-for-dollar match from the Candida Fund. So please donate today, and thanks.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, things are pretty quiet. The president continues his holiday vacation in Hawaii, and Congress is on recess. The Conference Board issues its December Consumer Confidence Index, and 8 years ago, Saddam Hussein was executed in Baghdad. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Adrienne Hill in for Kai Rizdahl. The NFL's regular season ended yesterday, and that means today is Black Monday. That's when teams in the NFL take stock of their wins and their losses and pretty much fire everyone they aren't happy with. So long, head coaches. Farewell, general managers. So far, the New York Jets, the Atlanta Falcons, the Chicago Bears, and the San Francisco 49ers have all announced their cleaning house. But the same teams will also have to scramble to find replacements. Marketplace's Sally Herships has more on what it means to fire and hire so quickly.
It's hard for NFL teams to pick out new coaches. First, the very people who are supposed to be cheering for your team, the fans, can turn into your critics.
The pressure and the public scrutiny on these NFL franchises is greater than ever before.
Just check the New York Jets Twitter feed today. Abraham Madcor is executive editor of Sports Business Journal. He says the next problem is on the team side.
Owners realize that they don't necessarily have the eye of what could make a successful football coach. They don't know how a football operation should be structured, what type of culture you want, what type of team do you want to be.
To answer these questions, Madcor says more and more teams are bringing on executive search firms to help with hiring coaches, just like in corporate America. But that's where the similarity ends. Mike Leeds is a sports economist at Temple University.
Well, you rarely see an industry in which a whole series of high-ranking corporate executives in a given industry lose their jobs all at the same time.
In just one day. And to make things even more difficult for teams, for the most part, they're not allowed to headhunt coaches from the competition. That's called tampering.
The Jets can't go to the coach of the Eagles and say, you're doing a great job this season. How would you like to coach for us next season? That's not allowed in the NFL.
The result of this speed hiring and firing is often a decision teams regret but are locked into. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Designer Eileen Fisher started her clothing line in 1984. She had $350 in savings and a simple idea. Basically, that women wanted clothes they looked good in, without a lot of fuss. Turns out, she was right. 30 years later, there are 67 Eileen Fisher stores around the world. The brand employs 1,200 people. Eileen Fisher, it's good to have you with us.
My pleasure, Adrian. Thanks for having me.
So it's the 30th anniversary of your company, and I wonder, are you in the same business today as you were 30 years ago?
It certainly doesn't feel the same as it did then. No, it's the same business, but it's really a different business in that there are now 1,200 employees. It's actually a large business.
Who is Eileen Fisher's competition out there?
I never think about competition. It's crazy. I'm sure that others in the company think about that, but I don't think like that. You know, I really think we're doing something that's unique, and as large as it is today, I think it's still pretty unique.
How's the brand's aesthetic changed over the years?
Well, I think we have we've broadened a lot. And I guess one of the things is we do watch the trends, and we do think a lot about how our concept of timeless design belongs to the moment. So it's not, you know, so there's an attention to trend while keeping in mind what will be timeless about this particular moment in time.
And are you, with that broadening, trying to attract a different audience, a younger audience?
Yes, and you know, we just say a broader audience, and younger is part of it. We have many, you know, younger designers now. We have millennials in the company, and you know, so they just give it a different slant, and so it takes on a slightly different edge, maybe.
So I want to ask you a question that you probably get a lot, which is about the Nora Ephron line. When you start wearing Eileen Fisher, you might as well say, I give up.
Oh, you would have to bring that up.
What do you make of it?
I think maybe she didn't get it. I think my clothes are about ease and comfort. And mostly what I'm excited about is that actually women always say that my clothes have changed their life, and that they actually feel that they can be themselves in my clothes. And so I think that's a good thing. I'm not worried about it.
What is it like to be Eileen Fisher, to be the person with a name that actually stands for so many things to so many people?
Yeah, that's you nailed it. That's the weird one. You know, being me, being a brand, being credited for so many things that, you know, 1,200 people are doing, and you know, it's a hard role. It's hard shoes to fill, and sometimes it's kind of great, you know, when people walk up to you and say, "I love your clothes," or "What a great company you have." You know, it feels good, and I'm really proud. I'm really so proud of this company and all the wonderful people and all the wonderful work that they do. And I just hope that, you know, I represent them well.
Do you ever use an alias?
With a few friends, sometimes I do. But I won't tell you what it is.
That's okay. But I wondered if you ever just said, you know, I need to be somebody else.
But it's funny because sometimes people will comment about my clothes or, you know, say something like if somebody takes my credit card, someone will say, "Oh, do you know there's a famous designer with your name?" And I'll say, "Yeah, I know that." And I'll just try to go anonymous.
Does it work?
Yeah, yeah. Because I don't think that I would be her, you know.
Eileen Fisher, thanks so much.
Well, thank you, Adrian. My pleasure.
It's been nearly a year since the state of Colorado legalized recreational marijuana use. Legal pot has not been without controversy about edibles, about keeping the drugs in Colorado. But so far, the green economy is paying off for the state. Colorado will take in more than $60 million in tax revenue from pot this year. Cities and towns have also done well. Elizabeth Pendleton is a Marketplace listener from Castle Rock, Colorado. It's a suburb of Denver. She tells us what the economy feels like to her.
Castle Rock is a bright spot in the economy. Things are looking really, really good here. To the west of us, the land was just rezoned for 45 new apartments. east of me, 60 new units are under construction. They're seeing the boom pretty much everywhere in the greater Denver metro area. I definitely think part of the prosperity is from the green economy. We have over 250 shops in the Denver area, which is more than we have Starbucks. I was out in Colorado during the election of 2012 thinking about buying, and I made a trip from North Carolina where I was living to look at a lot of prospective properties in the Denver metro area. Though I don't smoke or use the edibles, that definitely factored into my decision to purchase here. I just figured there would be a boom from it. I was a first-time buyer, so I was scared to death, literally, after the crash, you know, and definitely leery about putting down money that I had put aside all into one thing. Within 18 months of my buying it, it went up $34,000. Like landing on a good spot on the Monopoly board, it's been a great investment. When you go out shopping here, people seem to be enjoying their jobs, enjoying what they do. So, as I'm looking into the new year, I'm feeling very optimistic. Definitely careful, definitely checking all the numbers. But from Castle Rock, Colorado, it looks pretty good.
That's Marketplace listener Elizabeth Pendleton from Castle Rock, Colorado. We want to know what the economy feels like to you. Go to our website, marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
One final word before we go today. Bay. Bay, for those of you who don't know, is a favorite word of kids these days. I actually had to ask my 23-year-old colleague for a definition. Basically, bay is a term of endearment. Now brands are getting in on the bay action, trying to be bay with everyone on social media. A Twitter account has even popped up, Brands Saying Bay, to make fun of the corporate play to be cool. Brands like Whole Foods tweeting out, "Thanks, Bay," or "We'd totally be your Bay." Really, Whole Foods? Bay? And that's our show for this Monday. The Dow traded down less than a tenth of 1%. The Nasdaq traded flat. And the S&P 500 ticked up 1 point, about a tenth of a percent. My bays on the production team are Bridget Bodner, Tommy Andres, Daisy Palacios, and Millie Jefferson. I'm Adrienne Hill. I'll see you here tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.